You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. On Nightlife, Keziah Weir writes, "Their kind of town. At La Dolce Vita, new owners reimagine one of Sinatra's favorite haunts, with his daughter on board. In the photos, Frank Sinatra and his daughter, Tina Sinatra, in 1969. A La Dolce Vita tablescape. Sinatra's Fly Me to the Moon lithograph. I have an over-acute capacity for sadness as well as elation," Frank Sinatra told Playboy in 1963. "I guess the audience feels it along with me. They can't help it. Sentimentality, after all, is an emotion common to all humanity. It's perhaps no surprise that the crooner found a side hustle in another deeply emotional medium, food. 3 years later, he became a founding investor in the Red Sauce restaurant La Dolce Vita, a slice of Italian New York nestled in the heart of Beverly Hills. Now, 57 years on, and following a three-year closure, La Dolce Vita's new owners, Med Abrus and Mark Rose, the New York City-born restaurateurs behind Genghis Goen and The Spare Room, are channeling those strong feelings. A romanticism goes along with these types of places," says Abrus of White Tablecloth Dining. "And for us, it's about getting back to what makes going out so special." The restaurant, which reopened in March, serves Negronis and 50-50 martinis mixed at the seven-seat bar. The stools are reproductions of Charles Hollis Jones's 1960 Sinatra model, and a lithograph of one of the singer's paintings hangs prominently. While in the all-booth dining room, brick walls are washed in lilac, and the staff wears buttery wool jackets designed by Dennis Frisson, with gold buttons from the restaurant's original uniforms. Rose recommends ordering family style. A bottle of Barolo, clams, organata, bucatini al limone, a Caesar salad, shrimp fra diavolo, veal parmigiana, and spumoni for dessert. And this iteration will once again be Sinatra-backed. The singer's daughter, Tina, a film producer, is investing in the place where she once celebrated special occasions with her father. He loved to sit at a round table in the lounge area, never with his back to the door, she says, and to dine with a handful of friends. Thank you. In media news, Mousetrap. In 2013, Jonah Peretti blew up a nearly $500 million Disney BuzzFeed deal, then rode the digital media wave until it crashed, by Ben Smith. Opening illustration by Selman Huzgar, Buzzkill. Jonah Peretti, Ben Smith, and Bob Iger couldn't make this mega deal a reality. By the end of 2013, BuzzFeed was having it all. Our traffic hit 130 million unique visitors a month, riding Facebook's relentless growth. Some of our competitors had begun to imitate everything we did, which mostly amounted to making lists. Others promised to do the same thing we were, but without the embarrassing memes. In Silicon Valley, an ambitious former Goldman Sachs banker named Carlos Watson persuaded an old friend, Laureen Powell Jobs, to finance a website called Ozy that would aim to be a smarter, slicker, more socially conscious BuzzFeed. And in that frothy moment, it seemed to make sense for America's best media company and its safest brand to buy us. Disney, to the degree it had been aware of BuzzFeed at all, had noticed the rather generous interpretation of fair use of its copyrights in items like, "Which Disney princess are you?" But Disney was also scrambling to figure out how it fit into a rapidly changing digital world. And in the spring of 2013, Ben Sherwood, the former Wunderkind producer turned president of ABC News, which Disney owned, sat with the company's chief executive, Bob Iger, at the Coral Tree Cafe in Brentwood and asked him if he'd ever heard of BuzzFeed. Iger said he had, but hadn't really looked deeply into it. Sherwood explained that ABC News, in his view, had fallen dangerously out of sync with the times as corporate media lumbered toward what would be referred to in conference room PowerPoints as digital transformation. What the place really needed, he said, was a DNA transfer. BuzzFeed was the mid-aughts brainchild of Jonah Peretti, an online culture jammer turned business operator who had already co-founded left-leaning juggernaut The Huffington Post with Arianna Huffington, Kenneth Lehrer, and the late Andrew Breitbart. When I joined BuzzFeed as editor-in-chief in 2011, it was a popular destination for videos of cuddly critters and viral memes. I was tasked with building a news operation propelled by the social web. And as the Twitter-fueled 2012 election got going, we were competing with legacy media stalwarts and newcomers like my former employer, Politico, and getting on the radar of behemoths like Disney. If Disney bought BuzzFeed, the entertainment giant could massively increase the internet company's value by juicing its ad sales. And meanwhile, BuzzFeed would BuzzFeedify ABC News' website and reverse its aging audience demographics. Iger liked what he saw, and he knew he could get in touch with Lehrer, with whom he discussed a Huffington Post investment in 2008, and who was now BuzzFeed's chairman. Iger's deal guy, Kevin Mayer, a rangy, gregarious executive whom many saw as the next CEO, liked it too. Disney needed a way to deliver its shows on the internet and to circumvent the movie theaters and television stations that represented the dying 20th century. Peretti huddled with Lehrer, and on September 30th, emailed him a long list of the things that would make him want to do the deal, at a price, he proposed, of $600 million. "I want to chase Yahoo and MSN in scale, and the New York Times in quality," Peretti wrote. He proposed developing a new cast of online-only Disney characters in collaboration with Disney Team. One of them should be gay, all of them should be inspiring, have good values, and a contemporary positive style. Plus, he would insist on continued editorial independence for Ben Smith. He and I were in the middle of recruiting a star investigative editor, Mark Schuffs, from the nonprofit ProPublica, and he had an inkling of how hard it would be to make money in that line of work. So he proposed asking for $5 million a year for investigative journalism. Through the fall of 2013, Iger talked to Peretti and Lehrer as Disney accountants and strategists quietly examined BuzzFeed's books, and on October 24th, we were invited to the House of Mouse. We traveled to Los Angeles with a pretext. BuzzFeed was opening a cavernous new office, a former soap factory on Beverly Boulevard. But the real point of the trip was the meeting at Disney Studios in Burbank, a set of old Hollywood buildings designed by Walt himself. Iger met us at the top of the elevator in the softly lit executive floor. He was alone, relaxed, wearing a sweater, and acting like an uncle who was thrilled you'd made it in time for Thanksgiving dinner. Peretti was wearing a button-down shirt with three shades of brown checks, crisp but not tucked in. The event had the false informality of all contemporary business meetings. Iger had just gotten back from Washington, he mentioned, and was so grateful we'd been able to make time for him. He didn't mention he'd been meeting with President Barack Obama. I sat on one side of the long table with Peretti, BuzzFeed President John Steinberg, and Zee Frank, Peretti's old internet friend who had started BuzzFeed's fast-growing video arm. A half-dozen Disney executives sat on the other. Iger and Peretti each delivered long speeches laying out the company's value to each other. Peretti had been making a study of Iger and had come to understand that the role of a CEO at that level was twofold. Iger was a banker, deciding where to allocate resources, and a politician, finessing personal relationships and a public message. I watched Peretti imitate Iger, then watched Iger mirror Peretti's own speech back to him, structuring his discussion of Disney's plans to match Peretti's monologue on BuzzFeed's aspirations. To Peretti, this was Disney's most compelling aspect, the chance to study a true master and to learn from him, to be one of 13 people reporting directly to the most successful CEO in modern media. We drove back from the lot to Pala Hotel, a slick-looking but inexpensive spot on Melrose, where Peretti's room had a balcony over an alley. Steinberg had finagled a prescription for legal marijuana, then a novelty, and while we smoked, Peretti solicited our input. I told him that we were building something great at BuzzFeed, that we were just getting started, that Disney's corporate culture would stifle us. Frank had already told him the same. Steinberg was shocked we'd consider saying no. He left the meeting with Iger on a high, believing that his longtime dream was coming true. Steinberg had loved Disney since he was a 15-year-old intern there. He had spent the best summer of his life working on the Aladdin virtual reality attraction, and he still took his family to the theme parks every year. From the perspective of a media company, an offer from Disney was like getting into Harvard, Steinberg said. And from the perspective of a venture-backed startup, the deal was a no-brainer, too. Steinberg's father was a top Manhattan real estate broker, and he taught his son the industry wisdom that the first offer you get is probably the best one. Steinberg got down on his knees on the balcony to plead with Peretti to take the deal. While I receded into a corner, alternately spaced out and laughing hysterically, and while Steinberg begged, Peretti grew even more abstracted than usual. He conducted a kind of Socratic dialogue with Steinberg, in which he seemed at times to be talking to himself. He asked why Steinberg really wanted to do the deal, and Steinberg scrambled to give whatever answer would push Peretti toward yes. You just want money, right? Yes, Steinberg said. But is it really money you want, or is it status? You don't just want a house. You want it in the right part of the Hamptons, right? Sure, yes, status. Steinberg tried to lead Peretti back toward the wisdom of the deal, but Peretti seemed to be exploring his own motives, wondering what he actually wanted as he towered over Steinberg, laughing. Peretti didn't seem to care about money, and he had a kind of reverse snobbery about the status money would buy. He didn't even like the theme parks, Peretti told his appalled deputy. Steinberg was crushed and furious at me and at Frank. He believed, probably rightly, that if the three of us had been unified, we could have brought Peretti along. Steinberg and I both stumbled to bed, convinced Peretti would turn the deal down. Back in New York, when the details came in, it became clear that this was an offer that Peretti almost couldn't refuse. Disney was the most admired media company in the world, with a record of well-managed acquisitions like Marvel and Pixar. The price on offer was $450 million, with the potential of earning $200 million more, an extraordinary sum for a company that had priced itself at less than half that just 9 months earlier, and whose connection to Disney, a company obsessively protective of its image and its wholesome brands, was just a series of posts like 21 completely bizarre moments in Disney history. Number 5, when Donald Duck promoted condoms during World War II. Iger was persuasive. Peretti, Steinberg, and Lehrer met nightly in the latter's Upper West Side living room, and Lehrer heard them both make their cases. Steinberg's to sell, Peretti's about the risk of being stifled by Disney and the potential upside he still saw in the company's independence. Lehrer knew Peretti would bridle at being pushed too hard, so he tried to nudge his protege toward saying yes. The deal really was, by any normal standard, a no-brainer. On October 29th, Peretti and Lehrer flew back to Los Angeles, this time staying in Lehrer's preferred hotel, the Chateau Marmont. At 9, the next morning, they met Iger and Mayer to go back over the details we'd discussed in the same building 5 days earlier. Then they all shook hands, and at least some of the men left the room thinking the deal was done. And then, on the flight back, Peretti turned to his seatmate. He didn't think he could do it. Lehrer, incredulous and quietly furious, told Peretti to call Iger and end the talks that day. Peretti thought it would be more honorable to call it off in person, and so he instead called Iger to say that he wasn't committed and he'd like to meet again, and suggested they talk after Peretti's planned speech to Disney's management retreat in Orlando 12 days later. Peretti was still feeling his old partner Lehrer's anger when he traveled to Disney World in Orlando on November 13th to speak to the company. The event was, for some 250 Disney higher-ups, the people who get to skip the lines at the theme parks, a nearly sacred gathering, running Thursday to Sunday at the sumptuous Grand Floridian Resort. Iger's smooth public persona dominated the gathering. Executives worked out at 4 a.m. in hopes of running into him at the gym, and if they didn't see him, returned at 6 a.m. They were the people who ran theme parks in Asia and cruise lines in Europe and sold content in Latin America and Australia. They signed up for essentially mandatory and strangely competitive sporting events like softball. When Peretti looked down at them from the stage in the grand ballroom, he saw people dressed like their boss, strenuously casual in shorts and collared T-shirts, ready to pretend to be relaxed. As they gathered, Mayer mentioned to Sherwood that Peretti had asked to meet privately after the speech, shooting his colleague a quizzical look that said, "Weird guy." But if that was how he wanted the signing ceremony to go, that was fine. As they watched Peretti deliver his speech, trepidation grew for the executives who had worked on the deal. While Iger had staged Peretti's speech in a marquee slot to welcome him to the family, the BuzzFeed founder didn't seem to have prepared with any special care. There were no particular references to Disney, to his audience, his future colleagues. Those who had watched his speeches on YouTube recognized recycled jokes, his yarns about the Nike email and Black People Love Us, and his slides of corgis. As Peretti delivered one of his standard edgy monologues, he liked to ask whether Mormons were better than Jews, and explained that the real difference was about the quality of their distribution networks. An HR executive blanched and told the person sitting next to her that they might have a problem. Peretti knew he could make himself, his investors, and many of the people who worked for him rich. He knew that the decision was still his to make, and while he was leaning against accepting Disney's offer, he took the stage without quite having decided. But the reception of his speech confirmed his decision. Peretti had never gotten fewer laughs in his life. He had a vision of himself having to explain the internet to these suits for the rest of his career, while they stared blankly back at him and missed his jokes. The things he had valued from the start when he built a company in his own image was freedom, his own and others, sometimes to a fault. Peretti couldn't see himself as an officer on this tight ship. He thought of something his old friend and investor Chris Dixon once said to him. "Do you know how many lame rich guys there are, and how few people who really build something?" Peretti just couldn't do it. He walked off stage and into a room with Iger and Mayer. There, he told them apologetically that his heart wasn't in it. The deal was off. There had been a car ready to take him to celebrate. Peretti took it to the airport. Iger, who could blow up and regain his cool within seconds, was furious that Peretti had walked away from the deal, and equally puzzled that Peretti had accepted the speaking invitation first. "F him. He loses. That company will never be worth what it would have been worth with us," he said to another executive. But there was no looking back. 4 months later, Disney announced it would buy Maker Studios, which helped YouTube stars like the gamer PewDiePie sell advertising for roughly the same $500 million it had considered spending on BuzzFeed. For Lehrer, Peretti's theatrical decision marked the first break with his protege. Steinberg was heartbroken. He thought Peretti was out of his mind, and realized simultaneously that BuzzFeed was Peretti's company. The next thing Steinberg did, he vowed, would be entirely his own. He started racking up appearances on CNBC, studying how business news got made. Frank and I were relieved by Peretti's decision, which meant we could go back to making videos and breaking news. We fully believed that the winds of history were out our backs, and that we'd look down at the pittance Disney offered us one day and laugh. And Frank and I weren't the only ones who admired Peretti's balls. In Silicon Valley, that self-effacing boldness and egotism were catnip, and the charts of traffic and revenue pointed ever upward. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, legendarily, had turned down a $1 billion offer from Yahoo in 2006, defying many of his advisors. Peretti could now go and tell his Disney story to the same people, show off his traffic, take their money, and keep growing. Peretti's decision didn't look like a mistake at first. BuzzFeed and its generation of media, Gawker, Vice, Vox, kept growing, playing central roles in the decade's culture and news. Even as their revenue numbers began to miss their targets, the growth fueled by Facebook and the sheer sense of destiny kept the hot financial markets open to raise more money, in retrospect, than they'd be worth. As their businesses weakened and their brands aged, they rode different paths down the hype cycle. Hulk Hogan and Peter Thiel destroyed Nick Denton's Gawker empire. Vice, the best brand and the least credible business of the group, has collapsed under the sheer weight of its own $5.7 billion valuation and appears to be ready to be sold off for parts. Vox has steered carefully through the wreckage and recently raised $100 million on terms similar to the ones it was offering in 2014. BuzzFeed, which had by then swallowed HuffPost, was the only one to make it to the public markets. riding the very end of the SPAC craze in 2021 to a messy public offering. I'd spent 8 years leading a newsroom that, at its best, broke some of the biggest, most serious stories in the world, without leaving behind our roots in some of the weirdest parts of the internet. But I was gone by then, writing for the New York Times, where I'd managed to make trouble for various of the other characters in my book, an occupational hazard in writing about media when your sources, targets, and colleagues are the same people. In one of my first pieces, I wrote about Iger's apparent return to power at Disney as COVID-19 spread, an article that infuriated his successor, Bob Chapek, and led to Iger's temporary ouster. In one of my last, I wrote about Watson's Ozymedia, which had gone from fake-it-till-you-make-it startup tactics to an astounding set of alleged felonies. We covered his arrest this year at my new media outlet, Semaphore. In the cold terms of venture capital, Paredes, our decision not to sell to Disney, will go down as one of the dumbest in the history of digital media. 9 years after BuzzFeed turned down Iger's offer, the company's market capitalization is hovering well below half what Paredes could have sold it for. Still, Paredes says he doesn't regret turning down the Disney deal. And I don't either, though I'm sure our investors do. At the time, the upward trajectory seemed clear. Social media would swallow the old internet, and we'd rise with it. And for a couple more years, we seemed to be rising, whether we were goofing around in the White House with Obama or breaking news from a darker and darker Trump campaign. But our big prediction was wrong. Social media turned dark and began to contract. Now, as social media's fortunes continue to decline, BuzzFeed is working to unhitch its fortunes from that generation of platform. Paredes' big new bet is on AI and the possibility of taking BuzzFeed's playful and experimental DNA onto that new emerging space, the kind of boundless digital universe he'd always preferred to a corporate retreat in Orlando. This article was adapted from the book Traffic, Genius, Rivalry, and Delusion in the $1 billion Race to Go Viral by Ben Smith, to be published May 2nd by Penguin Press, copyright 2023 by Ben Smith. Gold Rush. Oscar winners, fashion icons, and Hollywood legends pose in style for photographer Mark Seliger at the 29th annual Vanity Fair Oscar party. Opening photo, Michelle Yeoh, Academy Award winner for Best Actress in Everything Everywhere All at Once, wearing Giorgio Armani Privé with jewelry by Musayef High Jewelry. Next photos, Kiwi Kwan, Academy Award winner for Best Supporting Actor in Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Gigi Hadid. Kenta Brunson, creator and star of the hit TV show Abbott Elementary. Human rights activist Malala Yousafzai, an executive producer of Stranger at the Gate, nominated for Best Documentary Short Film. Musician Rita Ora poses with her husband, Academy Award winner, writer, director Taika Waititi. Brendan Fraser, Academy Award winner for Best Actor in The Whale. Austin Butler, Academy Award nominee for Best Actor in Elvis. Justin Bieber and Hailey Bieber. Angela Bassett, Academy Award nominee for Best Supporting Actress in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Channing Tatum. Cardi B. Poses with rapper Offset. Ana de Armas, Academy Award nominee for Best Actress in Blonde. The Academy Award-winning team behind Best Original Song, Natu Natu, from the film RRR, lyricist Chandra Bose and composer M.M. Keeravani, with the film's director S.S. Rajamouli. Megan Thee Stallion, Pedro Pascal, Ruth E. Carter, Academy Award winner for Best Costume Design for Black Panther, Idris Elba, Jennifer Coolidge, all attending the illustrious Vanity Fair Oscar party.
Thank you.
Now for the May 2023 Vanity Fair cover story, The King's Dominion by Gabriel Sherman, with opening photo by Marco Grob of Rupert Murdoch. His sons are at war. He's divorced his fourth wife and broken an engagement to a would-be fifth. The jewel in what's left of his crown faces a billion-dollar lawsuit. Will the division Rupert Murdoch spent his life fostering undo his empire? On the afternoon of July 2, 2022, Rupert Murdoch's black Range Rover pulled up to a 12th-century stone church in Westwell, a storybook Cotswolds village 75 miles west of London. The then 91-year-old Fox Corporation chairman traveled to the Oxfordshire countryside to attend his 21-year-old granddaughter Charlotte Freud's wedding. Invitations instructed the 70 guests to wear formal theatrical attire. Murdoch emerged from his SUV looking like Tom Wolfe in a white suit, red suede shoes, and red tie. Then he nearly collapsed. A day earlier, Murdoch was in a bed at Cromwell Hospital in London, battling a serious case of COVID-19, two sources close to him said. Over the course of a week, doctors treated Murdoch's symptoms, labored breathing and fatigue, with supplemental oxygen and antibodies, one of the sources said. His recovery was frustratingly slow. At the wedding, Murdoch needed the help of his oldest son, Lachlan, to keep him on his feet. Rupert was very weak. Lachlan was holding him up to get from place to place, a guest recalled. COVID was only the most recent medical emergency that sent Murdoch to the hospital. In recent years, Murdoch has suffered a broken back, seizures, two bouts of pneumonia, atrial fibrillation, and a torn Achilles tendon, a source close to the mogul told me. Many of these episodes went unreported in the press, which was just how Murdoch liked it. Murdoch assiduously avoids any discussion of a future in which he isn't in command of his media empire. "I'm now convinced of my own immortality," he famously declared after beating prostate cancer in 1999 at the age of 69. He reminds people that his mother, Dame Elizabeth, lived until 103. "I'm sure he'll never retire," she told me when I interviewed her in 2010, a day after her 101st birthday. But unlike the politicians, Murdoch has bullied into submission with his tabloids. Human biology is immovable. There's been a joke in the family for a long time that 40 may be the new 30, but 80 is 80, a source close to Murdoch said. On March 11th, he turned 92. Although he is a nonagenarian intent on living forever, Murdoch has been consumed with the question of his succession. He long wanted one of his three children from his second wife, Anna: Elizabeth, 54, Lachlan, 51, and James, 50, to take over the company one day. Murdoch believed a Darwinian struggle would produce the most capable heir. He pitted his kids against each other their entire lives. "It's sad," a person close to the family said. Elizabeth was by many accounts the sharpest, but she is a woman, and Murdoch subscribed to old-fashioned primogeniture. She quit the family business in 2000 and launched her own phenomenally successful television production company. Lachlan shared Murdoch's right-wing politics and atavistic love for newsprint and their homeland, Australia. Lachlan was the golden child, the person close to the family said. But Murdoch worried that his easygoing son, who seemed happiest rock climbing, did not want the top job badly enough. In 2005, Lachlan, then News Corp's deputy chief operating officer, quit and moved back to Sydney after clashing with Fox News chief Roger Ailes and chief operating officer Peter Chernin. That left James as the heir apparent. For the next decade, James climbed the ranks, vowing to make the Murdoch empire carbon neutral and investing in prestige media brands like Hulu and the National Geographic Channel. but James's liberal politics and desire to make News Corp respected in elite circles rankled Murdoch, who continued to woo Lachlan with Ahab-like determination. In 2015, the older son agreed to return from Australia as his father's heir. It was a big slap in the face, a person close to James said. According to the throne, ascending to the throne and holding on to it are different propositions. Lachlan's future will be decided by his siblings, all of whom sit on the board of the trust that controls the company through a special class of stock. According to sources briefed on the trust governance, Murdoch has 4 votes, while Elizabeth, Lachlan, James, and Prudence, Murdoch's daughter from his first marriage, each have 1. Murdoch's daughters Chloe and Grace, from his 3rd marriage to Wendy Deng, have a financial stake, but no voting rights. After Murdoch's death, his votes will be distributed equally among the 4 eldest children, the source said. The question is, when Rupert dies, how are the kids aligned? Said a former News Corp executive. The central fault line remains the rift between James and Lachlan. According to sources, the brothers no longer speak. James is horrified by Fox News and tells people the network's embrace of climate denialism, white nationalism, and stolen election conspiracies is a menace to American democracy. But to overthrow Lachlan and get control of Fox, James needs Elizabeth and Prudence to back him, and that is hardly assured. James is a lone wolf, the former News Corp executive said. Politically, Elizabeth is liberal, but she has remained close with Rupert and Lachlan. She sat in a box with the pair at the Super Bowl. A person close to Elizabeth says she wants to enjoy the time she has left with her father. She's terrified of Rupert dying mad at her, the source said. Prudence, who has stayed out of the family business, is a wild card, the former News Corp executive said. While the finale unfolds, Murdoch is trying to prove he has one last act in him. But his erratic performance, which has thrown his personal life and media empire into disarray, has left even those in his orbit wondering if he's lost the plot. Last June, Murdoch abruptly left his 4th wife, model actor Jerry Hall. For 2 brief weeks this spring, he was engaged to Anne Leslie Smith, a 66-year-old former dental hygienist turned conservative radio host with QAnon-style politics. Smith told an interviewer in 2022 that COVID was a plandemic hatched by Bill Gates at Davos. Rupert has been radicalized by his own echo chamber, said a person close to him, explaining his initial attraction to Smith. In January, Murdoch scuttled a plan to merge Fox and News Corp, which would have centralized Lachlan's control over the television and publishing divisions, after major shareholders balked. It was a harebrained scheme. They got their ass handed to them by investors, said a person close to the Murdochs. Murdoch's most damaging error, though, has been Fox News' coverage of President Donald Trump's 2020 defeat and its aftermath. The crisis has led to an existential threat. The $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit Dominion Voting Systems brought against Fox News. The blockbuster trial is set to begin in April, but even if the parties settle before then, Dominion's legal filings have already publicized internal communications that revealed those at the highest levels of Fox News didn't believe Trump's stolen election conspiracies, even as the network was cravenly promoting the lies for ratings. In one email, Murdoch called Trump's fraud claims really crazy stuff. I've covered Fox News for more than a decade, and wrote a 2014 biography of Ailes, its longtime chairman and CEO. The Dominion lawsuit is the worst crisis at the network I've seen. In their own words, Fox hosts have been exposed as propagandist. If we lose this suit, it's effing bad, a senior Fox staffer told me. There is an irony to Murdoch's current woes. He monetized outrage and grievance to build a conservative media empire that influenced politics on three continents for the last half century. Now, these same forces are threatening to destroy his legacy, his still vast media empire, and the family that stands to inherit it. To understand how Murdoch got to this embattled chapter of his reign, it's helpful to go back to 2015 and a brief moment when he had everything he wanted. He had recruited his favorite son, Lachlan, back to News Corp after a 10-year absence to be his heir apparent. He had rehired Rebecca Brooks, the former CEO of his British tabloids, whom Murdoch treated like a surrogate daughter, after a London jury acquitted her of four criminal charges related to the phone hacking scandal that roiled his UK business a few years earlier. An American election was on the horizon, and Fox News was primed to put a Republican in the White House after 8 years of Barack Obama. At the age of 84, newly divorced from Ding, Murdoch fell in love with the supermodel Jerry Hall. Murdoch seemed like the last man Hall would go out with. The 1970s fashion icon was a BBC-watching liberal, 25 years Murdoch's junior. She previously dated rock stars Brian Ferry and Mick Jagger, her longtime partner, with whom she has four children. In 2013, Hall was in Melbourne playing Mrs. Robinson in the stage version of The Graduate, when her friend Penny Fowler, Murdoch's niece, suggested they meet. Murdoch and Hall spent months emailing and talking on the phone before she agreed to a lunch date in New York. When Hall arrived, her hotel room was filled with flowers and chocolates. "He was an old-fashioned gentleman. We laughed together nonstop," she told friends. A couple of nights later, Murdoch took her to see Hamilton. Soon, they were a couple. "They seemed, to our surprise, very happy and a wonderful fit," recalled Hall's close friend Tom Cashin, who socialized with the pair. After a few weeks of dating, Murdoch and Hall flew on his private G650 jet to Texas to meet Hall's Fox News-loving family. Hall left Texas at 16 to model in Europe, but as she watched her relatives line up to receive Murdoch, like he was the king of Red America, she realized that her family's approval meant a lot. 6 months into the relationship, Murdoch proposed. "Mick was so unfaithful to you. I'd never be unfaithful," Murdoch told Hall, according to a person briefed on the conversation. They wed at an 18th-century mansion in London in March 2016, 7 days after Murdoch's 85th birthday. "No more tweets for 10 days or ever. Feel like the luckiest and happiest man in world," he posted after the ceremony. Murdoch's luck quickly ran out. He came down with a bad flu on their honeymoon in the south of France, according to a source. Then, in July, former Fox & Friends host Gretchen Carlson sued Ailes for sexual harassment. Murdoch desperately wanted to protect a longtime lieutenant and the $1 billion in annual profits he delivered. But after Carlson's suit spurred dozens of women to come forward with horrific accounts of sexual abuse at Fox News, James and Lachlan, longtime Ailes antagonist, forced Murdoch to push Ailes out. James seized an opportunity to steer Fox to the center and recruited then-CBS News president David Rhodes as Ailes' replacement. Rupert and Lachlan blocked the plan, but Rupert taking the Fox News CEO title instead. The message was clear. Ailes was gone, but Fox News wouldn't change. With a background in newspapers, not TV, Murdoch delegated decisions to lower-ranking Fox News executives, but the network was in chaos. For the first time since it launched in 1996, producers had to make programming calls without Ailes' daily directives. As they grasped for a strategy, they saw one topic boosted ratings more than anything else: Trump. It's ironic that Murdoch's fortunes would become entwined with Trump's, because Murdoch found Trump appalling. Rupert knew he was an idiot, a person close to Murdoch said. Murdoch was a longtime champion of immigration reform and free trade and loathed Trump's nativism and know-nothingism. During the Republican primary, Murdoch waged a media campaign in the pages of the Wall Street Journal and on Fox News to deny Trump the nomination. Once Trump was in the White House, however, Murdoch went all in. Fox News became de facto state TV. It was a continuation of Murdoch's time-tested strategy of forging alliances with politicians across the ideological spectrum as long as they advanced his interest. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.